It's good to be here. Thank you for having me back. And to deliver the next instalment of our church history, before we're going to do that, we're going to read the Word of God in Psalm 126, the 126th Psalm. Familiar words. Psalm 126, a song of ascents. When the Lord brought back the captivity of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with singing. Then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are glad. Bring back our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the south. Those who sow in tears shall reap in joy. He who continually goes forth weeping, bearing seed for sowing, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. Really, the psalmist reminds us there, isn't he? He's talking of times when he's saying, you did great things for us, Lord, do them again. And I think we need to always be saying that, don't we? And we're going to look at some of the great things the Lord did here. And in an extraordinary way as well, because this, I've called this talk, The Struggle for Pure Churches, number four. And yes, it is the last of those, because we come to a really significant point. This struggle was won by the grace of God. In our land, the struggle to be able to have churches like this, where you have a church which is independent of the state, it can appoint its own leaders, it can preach the gospel and the Bible in all its fullness without fear of a knock on the door or somebody stopping you or shutting your doors. Excuse me a minute. I'm just going to move that, because otherwise either I'm going to walk into there or I'm going to walk into here. Right. And this battle was won, and we're going to look at the period 1662 to 1715 and see that, and it starts at a time when really you would have thought that the battle was lost. For 100 years since Elizabeth had established the Church of England, there'd been this struggle for biblical churches. And after the restoration of the monarchy under Charles II at the end of Cromwell's reign, it seemed that this battle was lost, as I said. We begin to get the Clarendon Code, named for the Earl of Clarendon, who was effectively Charles's Prime Minister, not quite that title yet. The Act of Uniformity, which had driven out all those Puritans from the Church of England. So Puritanism, in its strict sense, had ceased. We now have to say you have either people in the Church of England who have to swear they're not going to try and change it, or you have people outside and the separatists joining them with the Puritans who'd left, and from now on you'd call it nonconformity or dissent. They are totally the same terms. The Church of England, only those allowed in it who agreed not to try to change it, Puritans expelled. And it looks hopeless, doesn't it? And then various acts of this Clarendon Code again passed, 1664, the Conventicle Act, which said that it was illegal to meet in a house with more than the immediate family and more than five other people for religious purposes. In other words, it was saying, well, if you're not going to be allowed to build your own buildings, we're going to stop you meeting in houses either, running a church in a house. But then the plague struck in London, and it was the ministers who'd been silenced and ejected who tended to stay put and help the people while others fled. The Parliament itself fled to Oxford. And during this time, there does seem to have been a great awakening, or at least an awakening in London, a spiritual awakening. Death can concentrate the mind. If the plague is the sort of thing where you can wake up well in the morning and be dead and buried by the nightfall. And ministers were going around preaching the gospel to the people and helping them. Ex-Puritan ministers, mostly. But Parliament in Oxford passed an act called the 5 Mile Act, which said that anyone who had been ejected from the Church of England was not allowed to live within any corporate borough or within any 5 miles of one or of any place where they had previously ministered. It was to break up the ministers from their congregations so they didn't just take their followers with them and start a church. But then in 1672, we're moving on, this is 10 years now of this persecution. Charles, who was a secret Roman Catholic and was trying to favour the Catholics, issued a declaration of indulgence. We're going to see several of those in this period, highly dubious constitutionally as to whether the king could simply say, Parliament has said this, passed laws, but I'm going to do the opposite. But he thought he could. And he declared that the Roman Catholic Mass was going to be legal in private. And because he didn't want everybody just saying, oh, you're favouring the Catholics, he also allowed for the licensing of ministers and of places of worship. Nonconformist ministers and places of worship were now allowed under licence by the king. But Parliament reacted, it passed the Test Act, which said that all holders of civil or military office had to receive communion yearly according to the rites of the Church of England and also to make a declaration against transubstantiation. So you weren't going to hold civil office if you were a consistent Christian and nonconformist. In 1677, the particular Baptists took hold of the Congregationalist Savoy Declaration, which itself was an amending of the Westminster Confession. And they published their confession in 1677, which we call the 1689, but we'll come to see why that is in a moment. And they brought in additions from the confession that they made in 1644 and amended the Savoy, but they kept as close to it as possible. Again, we'll come back to that. And then there were various plots. Whether how much they really existed is a matter of historians' debate. 1678, the Popish plot to overthrow the government and take the country back to Rome. A man called Titus Oates denounced that. Was it really there? Well, it led to increased opposition to Rome. 1683, 5 years later, the Rye House plot. Again, did it really exist? A plot apparently to overthrow the House of Stuart. Again, persecution then increased. So you've got opposition to Rome amongst the people and opposition to the nonconformists. And yet, in 1683, when John Owen, this great theologian, died, a Congregationalist, of course, 60 noblemen and a vast number of people followed his coffin to Bunhill Fields. Certainly in the London area, there was a lot of nonconformity. Charles died in 1685. And read just a little bit. This is Wiley's History of Protestantism, as I said last time. You have copies at the back if you want to read it. This is the one with the pictures in. I think that one might have as well. He says of the king who had previously been in good health was suddenly seized with a violent illness. The symptoms of the malady all agreed with those of poisoning. When it became evident that the king was dying, priest Huddleston was admitted by a back door with the materials for mass. Charles received the sacrament, and the host having stuck in his throat, it was washed down with a draught of water. After this, the king became calm. The English bishops were now admitted, but Charles paid no attention to their exhortations. He gave special directions to the duke, his brother, about his mistresses, but he spoke not a word of his wife, nor of his subjects, nor of his servants. Probably not a good advert for deathbed conversions, though in fact he secretly had been a Roman Catholic years before. Now, before we finish that reign, I think this is the point to introduce, as I try to do in these studies, to you to a few famous, or should be famous, people. Famous particular Baptists in this occasion. We've looked at some Presbyterians, some Congregationalists. The first one is John Bunyan, born in 1628, who joined the Parliamentary Army, served in it for a couple of years, and then became a tinker in Elstow, just outside Bedford. Married, and seems to have heard, or he thought he heard at least, a voice from the heavens at one point, "Wilt thou leave thy sins and go to heaven, or have thy sins and go to hell?" It brought him under conviction of sin. He had 18 months of agonising about his sins. He was converted, he was baptised. He joined the Bedford Free Meeting, which was a mixed congregation of Baptists and Congregationalists. He began to preach in the church and the surrounding countryside. In 1660, he was arrested and sentenced to 3 months' imprisonment in Bedford County Jail. He refused to agree to give up preaching and was then sentenced to 12 years in prison. He wrote Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. While in prison, he started writing The Pilgrim's Progress. In 1671, while still in prison, he was chosen as pastor of the Bedford meeting. In 1672, he was released under the Declaration of Indulgence, and The Pilgrim's Progress was published in 1678. 100,000 copies were sold by 1688. It used to be, I don't know if it still is, always reckoned to be the second most sold book in English after the Bible. Probably not now, but it was. Until relatively recently, used to go into homes and you'd see people with four books or something, wouldn't it? The Bible and Pilgrim's Progress and probably a hymn book and Matthew Henry's commentary. That was what you had. We'll get to Matthew Henry. He also wrote other books, The Life and Death of Mr. Badman and The Holy War, which is worth reading, certainly, if you haven't. Another famous particular Baptist, a man called Hansard Knollys. He was born right back in 1598, so that's under Elizabeth. He'd lived through all these periods. He was ordained in the Church of England, but he resigned his charge in 1631. So again, we're still going back. Because he could not continue admitting wicked persons to the Lord's Supper. He went to America. In America, he was persecuted by the Congregationalists for his views on the gathered church. In 1641, he returned, became a Baptist by 1644. He went on preaching tours. He had held formal debates on believers' baptism. He opposed various heretics. After 1662, he was imprisoned twice, and he was still alive in 1689 when the confession came out. We'll come back to him. Another man called William Kiffin, born in 1616, converted at the age of 15 in London, listened to many Puritans, joined the Independents in 1638 and became pastor of an independent church in 1641. And the next year he and his congregation became Baptists. He was a cloth merchant. He was a wealthy man. He was MP for Middlesex for a year. He grew wealthy. Amusing tale told about him in this book, Kiffin, Knollys and Keach, which was written by Earl Hulse. He was a wealthy London merchant. He appears to have been on quite good terms with the king. According to a story which has come down to us, Charles was once in need of a large sum of money. He asked Kiffin for a loan of £40,000. That, in those days, was a large sum of money. Kiffin, it seemed, was aware that if he gave the king such a loan, there was every likelihood that it would never be repaid. He thus offered to make the king a gift of £10,000, which the king gladly accepted. Afterwards, when he recounted the story, Kiffin jocosely remarked that he had thereby saved himself £30,000. He wasn't going to get the 40 back, so he gave 10 instead. A wise man, perhaps. Debated with Bunyan in print about the open and closed communion, whether the closed communion position, I'm sure you know, of Baptist churches who say that only those who are baptised as believers should be allowed to take communion, and the open position saying Christians in good standing with Peter Baptist churches should also be allowed to take communion. Kiffin was on the closed side and Bunyan on the open side of that debate. He was the only man to sign both the 1644 and 1689 Baptist confessions. He died in 1701. And Benjamin Keach, the third of these men mentioned here, in 1675 was actually the first man to introduce hymn singing into Protestant nonconformist worship. There was a controversy about it, but it was settled in the end and the Baptists accepted the practice, and he published two hymn books which totaled 400 hymns, very few of whom are seen around now. And if you come across hymns by Keach, you can sadly possibly see why. He wasn't really a hymn writer. There are better hymn writers, let's put it like that. But he was a forerunner in the practice, and therefore we need to notice him because it's important. Under James II then, who reigned for 3 years from 1685, 1685, when he took over the throne, was in France the year of the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, which had given freedom under certain circumstances to Protestants. It was revoked. Many Huguenots fled into this country, particularly London, Kent, East Anglia, gave a great boost to nonconformity. He was an open Roman Catholic, James. He made a promise on his accession where he said, "I shall make it my endeavour to preserve this government both in church and state as it is by now law by as it is now by law established. I know too that the laws of England are sufficient to make a king as great a monarch as I can wish, and as I shall never depart from the just rights and prerogatives of the crown, so I shall never invade any man's property." Well, it sounded all right, but he refused to take communion according to the Church of England practice, even at his coronation, and the next Sunday went openly to Roman Catholic Mass. He published papers which had proved that his father, his brother Charles II, secretly became a Roman Catholic before becoming king. There was a lot of resentment. The Duke of Monmouth, Charles's illegitimate son, invaded the country with a ragtag army at Lion Bay with 3,000 people and was defeated at Sedgemoor, Battle of Sedgemoor, which led the way to Judge Jeffreys, who was made Lord Chief Justice, to his bloody assize, as it was called, where he would go around the West Country and try and find anybody who had any connection, or he could invent any connection with the rebellion, and hang them. He boasted that he hanged more men than all judges since William the Conqueror. He was, as a result of this, promoted as a reward to become Lord High Chancellor. Richard Baxter had to stand trial before him and was sentenced to be fined a very large amount of money. James established Popish and Jesuit seminaries. He put Roman Catholic clergy into Church of England livings. He proclaimed individual indulgences for particular Roman Catholics that they could have Mass in their homes. He ordered the clergy not to preach on controversial points, which meant not to attack Rome, as a result of which almost all did. They had been pushed too far. It was clearly this man, he was king, he'd only been king a year or two, and he's really just trying very quickly to turn the Church of England back into the Roman Catholic Church. There were many Protestant pamphlets. He set up a commission for ecclesiastical affairs to try to oppress those who would oppose him. In 1687, promulgated an indulgence that all tests and disabilities, in other words, where you weren't allowed to have these offices if you were a Roman Catholic or a nonconformist, were removed by royal prerogative. He had to do both sides. And nonconformists during this period had battles with their conscience sometimes. Should we take advantage of the indulgences that the king is putting out, which include us, when we know, A, he's only really doing it to do it for the Roman benefit of the Roman Catholics, and B, we don't agree they're lawful. But different people had different views on that. He did put various people into positions in Oxford and Cambridge universities, Roman Catholics, clearly against the charters of the universities, and by methods which were clearly against the charters, where these people were meant to be elected, and he just imposed people. He was a master at raising up opposition to himself. Theresa May has nothing on him for being able to get everybody of all sorts of opinions against you. If he'd had a Brexit vote, he'd probably lost it by 600 out of 650 MPs. Before we come to his demise as a king, I want to just bring before you again two men who lived in this period. These are Presbyterians, famous authors. John Flavel, obviously we go back to his birth, 1627, in Bromsgrove, Worcestershire. He was a Presbyterian after Oxford. He trained in Oxford. He was sent by sent by the Standing Committee of Devon to Diptford, a little village, and then in 1656 moved to Dartmouth, which was an important town in those days, naval town. He was one who was ejected in 1662. He preached privately until the 5 Mile Act was passed. He then moved 5 miles away to Slapton and preached twice each Sunday, and many of his old parishioners came out to hear him. He was within the law in terms of at least where he was living. After the 1672 indulgence, he went back to Dartmouth. He had a period in London, but again back to Dartmouth, and died in 1691. His published sermons included The Fountain of Life Opened, or A Display of Christ in His Essential and Mediatorial Glory, Divine Conduct, or The Mystery of Providence Opened, usually just called The Mystery of Providence, and The Method of Grace in the Gospel of Redemption, and many others. More than 720 editions of Flavel's works have existed, and they're still in print. And then John Howe, the other man, born in 1630 in Loughborough in Leicestershire, went to under the Commonwealth to Great Torrington, also in Devon in 1654, preached in London for Cromwell, became a chaplain to him and to his son, went back to Torrington in 1660, was ejected, went to Ireland, came back in 1676, pastored a church at Haberdasher's Hall in London, went to Utrecht in 1685, but came back to London, headed a deputation of dissenting ministers in an address of welcome to the William of Orange, who we'll get to in a moment, died in London, and his best-known writings, The Living Temple, and his works too, still in print, well worth reading. And then we come, therefore, to the Glorious Revolution. This is the centrepiece of what we're saying today, 1688 to 89. In April 1688, James issued another declaration of indulgence to bring Roman Catholics in to the Church of England, and he ordered the clergy to read it from the pulpits, and people said, if we read this, we're reading our own death sentence, in terms of an Anglican Protestant church. Seven bishops asked to be excused. Far from excusing them, James put them on trial for seditious libel. Seditious libel actually carried the death penalty, or could do. I don't think anyone thought they would be put to death. What surprised people to some extent was that at the end of their trial, they were acquitted. And bonfires were lit and bells were rung in London at the acquittal of the seven bishops. Meanwhile, James had a son, probably did, June 10th, 1688, also known as James, who became the old pretender. William, Prince of Orange, had been next in line. He was married to James's daughter, Mary. And William was invited by the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Bishop of London, and most of the nobility to intervene. He gathered an army. He sailed on the 19th of October from Holland. He sailed with 14,000 men. And it's been described as a Protestant wind blew him all the way down the channel, which is not really where he wanted to go, to Tor Bay, where he landed, but it meant he landed a long way from London. But the same wind blowing from the east for many days kept the fleet in Harwich Harbour in Essex so that he couldn't be opposed. He landed unopposed on the 5th of November, again, 1688. James's army marched cautiously on Salisbury Plain, as far as Salisbury Plain, where it scattered and people disappeared. And James fled back to London. On Christmas Day, 1688, he fled to Calais, disguised as a fisherman. On his way over the Thames, he cast the great seal of the kingdom, with which Acts of Parliament had to be signed, into the River Thames, which was what was really considered as marking his abdication. If your king runs away from the country and throws away the great seal, he's probably declaring himself that he doesn't want to be your king. He was considered to have abdicated then, but he was captured, and in fact by other fishermen who realised that he wasn't one, and imprisoned in the Tower of London. It's difficult if you're a Catholic king probably to pretend to be a fisherman in Kent. He was allowed, however, after consideration, to escape to France. People thought that's just going to be the best thing. And a convention parliament was called, in other words, the House of Lords called an election because they were the remaining authority in the land. Parliaments in those days fell when the throne was vacant. They called another parliament, and parliament jointly declared William and Mary as king and queen, and passed laws for the toleration of all Protestants, the Toleration Act in 1689. Nonconformity and dissent were to be legal as an alternative to the Church of England. And that is the battle that was being fought, isn't it? That was what people wanted. It was just toleration. There were various restrictions on nonconformists, particularly still in terms of being able to occupy various offices in the land. But nevertheless, it was allowed now. You could set up chapels, you could just worship freely. The 1677 Baptist Confession was ratified again and published as the 1689 Confession. Knollys and Kiffin had called an assembly to do this. Knollys was the first name on the confession. As we said, Kiffin had signed both the 1644 and this one. The Independents, who'd revised the Westminster Confession, and then the Baptists, who revised their Savoy Declaration, both stressed that they'd use the Westminster Confession as a basis in order to keep unity between all Reformed nonconformists where possible, because their attitude was we need to stick together and we need to affirm the things that we all agree. And when we get on to church membership and baptism and church and state relationships and things, we're going to have different things in our confessions. But the main doctrinal parts we want, and many of them are still word for word in all three documents. Now, under William and Mary then, from 1689 to 1702, what happened? You might think this is the end. You might think this is where we stop. Hasn't the battle been won? Well, it has, but there was a reaction which we're going to have to come to, and I want to cover that today. But under William and Mary, in the first 11 years, 2,418 chapels were licensed, we know, because the register was kept of them. And it was estimated there were about 2 million dissenters, probably out of a population of about 6 million people. Now, if you work out the numbers, that means that these were either very, very large chapels, or they were completely full all the time. And probably, therefore, the dissenters number means people who would say they're dissenters rather than Church of England, and it doesn't mean they're all there every week. Nevertheless, as a sort of self-identification, a third of the population was saying that they were nonconformists. And this was the age of religious societies. 1691, a society for the Reformation of Manners was set up. You might think we need one of those today. In 1698, the Society for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge, SPCK. 1701, Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, and others as well. And why these societies? Well, they were all attempts by nonconformists and some Anglicans to work together. They were all saying, well, we think the best way of doing things is that we work together across our differences. I suppose, not saying that's absolutely equivalent, but you might think of something like Banner of Truth in terms of publication of books, or Christian Institute, or someone like that, saying we'll work across our differences for the things that really matter to all of us. And other societies, of course, have been founded ever since. But also, there were attacks coming from a different source. And really, we need to look at this for a little while. This is what we would call, bring under the heading of deism. Deism means belief in a God, but not necessarily the God of the Bible. And, of course, the reason this can come out now is because there is freedom. Under Cromwell, where there'd been freedom of practice, it had led to encouragement for people to interpret the Bible for themselves. And while it's excellent that each Christian reads the Bible and tries to work out what it means, sometimes that meant people saying, well, why should we listen to any preaching? No one else knows any more than we do. What I think is, I'm just going to follow that. Thinking for oneself is good, but if you think for yourself, and you get things wrong and you're not prepared to be corrected, that's not good. And of course, thinking for yourself doesn't mean in the end, and people quickly got to this position, you're not always thinking for yourself with the Bible as your guide. And many people saying, well, you know, yes, we're reading the Bible and we see Rome is wrong and we see the Church of England, well, that's not their national church. But they started saying, well, why do we need the Bible at all? And we can believe in a God, but we don't have to believe in everything the Bible teaches. And many came to reject the Bible, and the elevation came in of reason. People deliberately saying, you know, we, we are going to say we must follow reason. Now, we should all be reasonable people, but what they mean is this: by reason, I'll only accept what is reasonable to me. And if I find things in the Bible that I don't think make sense, well, it's too bad. I'm going to say, well, they're wrong then. And in the climate of toleration after 1689, such views were propagated openly. The veneration of reason led to certain things. It led to what is called natural religion. Reason alone leading to right thinking about morality and ethics and whether there's a future life. It could be seen in the preaching in the Church of England, where a movement called latitudinarianism came in, which basically meant there was less theology and more morality preached. And people weren't trying to convince their congregations of the great truths about Christ, about the Trinity, whatever. They were just saying, you know, well, here we are, we'll meet together, we'll go through the prayer book service, and then the sermon would all be nice to one another. It's not gone, is it? Deism also, or the veneration of reason rather, led to an increase in the interest in science. The Royal Society was founded in 1660. Isaac Newton played a leading part in it in its early days, and he also, of course, developed what had been around, but he developed and popularised the teleological argument for God's being. Teleos is to do with order, the idea that the order in creation proves a designer. He probably wasn't the first to say, but he certainly did say that we are thinking God's thoughts after him. So you see, here's a man who is believing there is a God, at least, and that he's made everything and that he's established laws, and by reason we can work these laws out, and it proves that God is there. But what God? Because many of these people, including Newton, though God was seen as the creator, the designer, the creator, the sustainer, there was the tendency to consider him as remote, hence deism. To use an analogy which came up later, William Paley's famous analogy that if you find a watch on a path and you look at what it's made of and how it works, you deduce that probably it didn't just fall out of the tree, there is a watchmaker. And that argument, which Richard Dawkins has tried to ridicule, but it's still absolutely valid. Well, the deists would say, effectively, of the universe, God may have made the watch, but he's wound it up and he's let it go, and he doesn't intervene in its working, and he probably never will intervene in its working. And so there's no such thing as miracles. There's no incarnation of Christ, no atoning sacrifice, no resurrection of Jesus from the dead, no such thing as regeneration, a miraculous working of the Holy Spirit in the soul, and no second coming. And different people, John Toland, 1696, Christianity not mysterious, you see, taking it head on. Lord Herbert of Charbury, others, put forward these ideas. And it led, even in the churches, to doubts, particularly over the doctrine of the Trinity, which was seen as unreasonable. Certainly in the Church of England, to some extent in the Congregationalists, and in a very large extent in the Presbyterian churches. The Presbyterians were devastated by deism. And this is just after, you know, the battle has been won to preach the gospel, and you see what Satan is doing. Having failed, because it's God's plan, to destroy the gospel churches and the propagation of the gospel by force and by law, he's now doing it by the back door. He's doing it by saying to people, okay, you're free to preach these things, but are they really true? You're free to believe them. You're free to talk about them. As you talk about them, well, are they really true? Has God really said? Where did that come from? You see what's happening. And that brings us to our last part of this talk. Under Queen Anne, 1702 to 1715, the younger daughter of James II, after Mary died and William inherited the throne. The throne now, after 1707, of the United Kingdom, the union of England and Scotland. The crowns had already been united, but now the kingdoms were united. Don't want to go into the politics of that. 1707 was also the year when Isaac Watts produced his hymn book. Watts was born in Southampton in 1674. His father had been twice imprisoned for nonconformity. In 1690, he went to the dissenting academy, because, of course, academies for nonconformists can now be set up, the dissenting academy at Stoke Newington. He became the pastor of Mark Lane Congregational Chapel. He's known as the father of modern hymnody, though we can see that that's a debatable title. He wrote Horae Lyricae, poems, chiefly the lyric kind, and then he rewrote Psalms from a Christian perspective, Psalms of David, imitated in the language of the New Testament and applied to the Christian state and worship. And we know of many, don't we, of those in our hymn books. He also wrote what became the standard textbook on logic, which was used at the universities of Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard and Yale. He was not, you know, just someone who just sat there and passed his church and wrote hymns. He also wrote a book called The Improvement of the Mind, which inspired Michael Faraday. You see, it's not wrong, is it, to use reason in the right sense? He is fully in favour of science, finding things out. You could have people then like him. You had people who were scientists who didn't believe in God coming up, and then you have people who would believe in God but would be very suspicious of science. But I think Hitler Watts was down in the right position here. In 1714, Matthew Henry's commentary was published. Just make that point, because you know, a very famous book, isn't it? And that's where it fits in. But persecution grew. In 1709, you had what is known as the Sacheverell case. Dr. Henry Sacheverell was a vicar in Southwark, and on the 5th of November, 1709, preached against the Glorious Revolution and against toleration. He was obviously clearly trying to stir things up. He was prosecuted, he was found guilty in the end by the House of Lords and forbidden to preach for 3 years. A mob destroyed some dissenting chapels throughout the country and supported Sacheverell. And she became determined to destroy dissent by legal means. And so you had effectively what is the beginning of another sort of Clarendon Code type series of acts. In 1711, there was the Occasional Conformity Act. Everyone was to be expelled from a public office if they attended dissenting worship, until they swore that they hadn't done so for a year and had received communion in the Church of England 3 times in that year. 1714, the Schism Act. No one was to keep any school or seminary unless licensed by the bishop, or to teach any catechism except the Church of England one. So this is aimed, isn't it, at not allowing children to be brought up under dissenting principles. And that was to begin on the 1st of August 1715, but God intervened. Thomas Bradbury, famous preacher in London, it was the Lord's Day, and he was standing in Smithfield Market in London, and he was approached by Gilbert Burnett, who was passing by. Burnett was the Bishop of London. They knew each other, and Burnett said to him, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "Well, I'm standing here wondering that if the fires are lit again, will I have the courage to stand for the gospel?" And Burnett said, "Well, take heart." He said, "I've just been at the palace and the Queen is on her deathbed. And I will let you know if she dies." And they arranged a sign. And Bradbury went to his church, began to preach. And during the sermon, someone made their way to the front of the gallery and they dropped a white handkerchief from the front of the gallery. That was the agreed sign. And Bradbury stopped in the middle of his sermon and announced, "Queen Anne is dead." And she was. And with her died the final nail in the coffin of attempts to take away the freedom of churches like ours. I say final. Who knows what's going to happen? But we're looking at church history. We're about 300 years. Final up till now. Whatever there are, of course, we know attacks on the gospel and on gospel churches. There is nobody seriously yet at the moment is there trying to pass anything through Parliament to say we should be closed down. We don't know what's going to happen. But we still have this freedom, which, and the freedom was won in 1689, 1688, 1689, and was threatened up to 1715, and then that threat was taken away. And when we come to the next, and I'm going to finish in a moment, then when we come to the next six talks, I think it will be, to take us up to today, it's a very the talks will be significantly different in a way. We won't have to keep looking at this king did this, this king did that, here's the threats. We're going to look at what God did. This is all what God did, but we're going to look at what God did and what churches did in the freedom, with the freedom. And then, again, the gathering clouds that came upon us. So I hope to be doing that in another six talks. But this is where we're going to leave it for now.